When you say that you're not racist, what we are doing is putting a distance between ourselves and any problem. I'm not racist. I'd never do those things. And so I don't need to engage in those things. Racism is something that happens externally to me. It's nothing to do with me. I don't need to do anything because it's not affecting me and it's not something that I'm doing. Whereas being anti-racist is taking a much more active stance. It's an action that we need people to take. And it's to say, I might not be racist, but I can see and acknowledge that racism exists in the world and seeing what we can do about that.
Welcome to the Power Done Differently podcast. I'm Cassandra Ray, and if, like me, you've grown a little disappointed and disillusioned with the people in power, you're in the right place. In this podcast, you'll meet powerful, passionate women who are doing power differently. Joining me this week is Sophie Williams, author of the books Anti-Racist Ally and Millennial Black. Sophie is a creative media producer by trade and has worked on several notable productions, including The Crown, Orange is the New Black, and The End of the Fucking World. But in May of 2020, just 3 days after George Floyd was murdered, and after, in her words, she spent the day crying, she posted some slides to Instagram detailing how she thought you could be an anti-racist ally. More than 70,000 likes, 2 books, and a TED Talk later, she has found herself as the voice of a movement. One of the suggestions Sophie makes for anti-racist allies is to, quote, just listen. Just listen to the experiences of marginalized groups, she says. You might be surprised what you learn. And so that's exactly what I've tried to do. Please enjoy my conversation with Sophie Williams. Sophie Williams, thank you so much for being here.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start this conversation on the concept of emotional labor, and I want to read directly from your book. You say in your book that emotional labor is, quote, the unpaid, often invisible work that's put on the shoulders of marginalized people when they are asked or expected to be unofficial teachers, pathfinders, and emotional support crutches of other people. So I guess I just wanted to start by acknowledging that what we're going to do here today in this conversation is going to involve emotional labor from you, and to thank you for that in advance.
Cool. No one's ever acknowledged that before. So thank you. Thank you for calling that out. Thank you for recognizing that. And I'm very happy to be spending some time talking with you.
Yes, I'm really privileged and grateful to have you here to explore some of these obviously very timely, long overdue topics that are complicated and nuanced and difficult to talk about. So I'm really grateful for your time and for your willingness to do this. Like a lot of people, I was really deeply affected by the murder of George Floyd and, of course, Breonna Taylor and the countless others that came before them. I mean, there have been so many in recent living memory, like, you know, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, like just so many, countless. But there was something about that moment in time and the movement that followed George Floyd's murder in particular that felt like a cultural awakening. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was also something, I mean, as an American, it was something of an American phenomenon and an American long overdue reckoning. And so I wanted to ask you, how did you feel as a Black British woman following George Floyd's murder?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And it's also interesting that the examples that you gave are all American cases. And I guess that's the sort of prism that you see it through. But the UK has Mark Duggan, we have Stephen Lawrence, we have again, countless people whose names we know and whose names we don't know who have suffered and lost their lives ultimately at the hands of racism. So I think it's tempting for people who are American to view it as an American problem, but it's absolutely not. It's a global problem. It's heightened in America potentially because the police carry guns and people can carry guns in a way that doesn't happen in the UK. But in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, which is also the wake of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor in the UK, Belly Majinga, who was at work when someone said that they had COVID and spat in her face and she died. And it was in the middle of the conversation about Black and global majority people being disproportionately impacted by COVID, more likely to die from the effects of COVID. Like, that was one singular moment, I think, in a way that we hadn't really experienced singular international moments before. I think it's no coincidence that the galvanizing moment in that, the murder of George Floyd, happened during a global pandemic where everyone was locked down, everyone was inside their houses, and the things that were happening in another country felt just as local as the things that were happening in your own home, because you couldn't leave the house anyway. Everything that was external was just one external space outside of my home. And so I think that's why the particular incidents of last year had a galvanizing effect that we haven't seen before, because suddenly we were all at home, we were all apart, we were all engaging on our phones and social and cultural media in a way that we hadn't before as a singular experience. And that, I think, became part of that singular experience of the mid part of 2020.
And as we're a year on, you know, I am closely watching the trial, obviously, in the States, but do you feel the movement, the awakening, you know, whatever it is, do you feel it's dying a little bit? Do you feel like it's evolving? Do you feel like it's as strong as ever?
I feel like it's hard to quantify. Because as well as living through a really important civil rights movement and moment, potentially the civil rights movement and moment of a generation, we're also experiencing, as I said, so many other things. We're experiencing life in a pandemic. We're experiencing so many things that we aren't and haven't been and couldn't be prepared for. And so it's hard for me, because I can see that when something else horrific happens and someone is murdered or deeply harmed, and particularly when that's filmed, we suddenly get this resurgence of people who are interested in this conversation and who want to sort of devote time and energy and effort to making a change. But no, I don't think it would be reasonable to say that that is consistent and has been applied consistently for the last 12 months, partially because there have been other news stories that have affected people, and partially because I think if we had been able to say, if on Wednesday everyone does this one thing, we will solve racism, I think everyone that Wednesday would have done that thing. But there is no solution. And people often like to say, like, what's the solution? What can we all do? And there is no singular thing that we can all do. It takes time. It takes commitment. And that's really hard to sustain in people, especially in people who don't feel the effects of the need for change in their own lives or on their own skin as directly as marginalized groups.
You mentioned that there's a response, an understandable response, when one of these events happens and it's filmed. And I've been thinking a lot, I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but there is an author called Elizabeth Lesser. She wrote a book recently called Cassandra Speaks, When Women Are the Story Changers, The Human Story Changes. And one of the, I think, theses of the book is that we have, by osmosis, kind of internalized these origin stories back from Adam and Eve and Greek mythology and all of these things. And one of those stories is like the story of Cassandra, which, you know, I know very well, obviously, because it's my name, but essentially is a woman who had the gift of prophecy, but was cursed that she would never be believed. And and so we have this history, this lived history of women, you know, constantly not being believed about, well, everything, you know, their sexual abuse and what have you. It's hard not to make the same parallels in this time about the suffering and the pain that has been inflicted upon the Black community that we are just now getting video of. So there is no way to deny it. But it's not like they haven't been telling these stories for decades and millennia.
Absolutely. I think so much of what was frustrating last year was the more important now than ever narrative, or the this is a new conversation narrative. And it's neither of those things. It's something that people have been living with and dealing with and talking about publicly and openly and passionately and honestly their whole lives, and their parents' lives and their parents' lives. It's just people weren't ready to listen to that before. And not only to say that people have been sort of living with that, that also means that another group of people have been inflicting that and still have not been willing to hear the true lived experiences of other people. And so it really makes me sad that there is a need for people to see these terrible things. I've not seen the murder of George Floyd, and hopefully I'm never going to, because I don't need that. I don't need to see someone dying in front of me, to know that this is true. So I think it's sort of double pronged. The fact that we can show is really important, but the fact that we need to is really disappointing.
We do have this moment in time where a lot of us, and you make the point so beautifully in both of your books, that it is nuanced. There's a lot of intersectionality in these issues, but a lot of us who might be from a more privileged group are doing a lot of introspection and hopefully also a lot of action at this time. Can you explain the difference between not being a racist and being an anti-racist and why it's important to know the difference and to be an anti-racist?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you say that you're not racist, what we are doing, I think, is putting a distance between ourselves and any problem. I'm not racist. I'd never do those things. And so I don't need to engage in those things. Racism is something that happens externally to me. It's nothing to do with me. So I don't need to think about it. And that is obviously a very passive state. I don't need to do anything because it's not affecting me and it's not something that I'm doing. Whereas being anti-racist is taking a much more active stance. Just so your listeners know, I'm inside a wardrobe at the moment that my cat would very much like to get into as well. So you might hear some cat noises and some crashing around, but you know, we keep going.
We've had cats and dogs and babies and we've had it all in lockdown. So please do not worry at all.
The joys of working from home. So not being racist is a very passive state, whereas being anti-racist is an active state. It's an action that we need people to take. And it's to say, I might not be racist, but I can see and acknowledge that racism exists in the world in all kinds of interpersonal and systemic and structural ways. And so being anti-racist is recognizing those things, recognizing the advantages that we haven't had to work for, recognizing the way that society treats us and it doesn't treat other people by default, and seeing what we can do about that. There's a really good example, and I don't remember the source, but I can try and find it later. There's a really good example that compares not being racist to being on the sort of like moving pathway that you have in an airport, which, you know, imagine being in an airport now, but I think we can all sort of picture what we mean. If you're passively not racist, you're just standing on that moving walkway. And that moving walkway is society, and it's just moving along, and you're not doing anything. You're not pushing it forwards, but you're just getting carried to wherever that is. You're not being active in anything. You're being taken along. Whereas when you're being actively anti-racist, you're making the decision to turn around and to walk in the opposite direction. And it's hard. It's much easier to stay still. And when you're being actively anti-racist and you're walking in the opposite direction, it can take energy even to just stay exactly where you are, because that is still moving in the same direction underneath your feet. And so that's why I don't think people can claim the sort of sticky label of I am anti-racist, claim the sticky label of I am an ally, and stick that to themselves as a name badge, because it's a constant process. It requires constant action. It requires constant walking forwards. And if you don't continue to walk forwards, you'll end up back where you started or even further along the line. So to me, being anti-racist is an active state where we are constantly trying to make better choices and do better work and uplift other people. Whereas not being racist is just saying, well, this is nothing to do with me, and carrying on your journey.
I think it's a really good point that you make about the energy, and that the energy you might need to expend just to stay still on that moving walkway. I mean, we're at this moment in time where we have so much information available to us, but there are also so many problems to solve, big problems to solve, right? I mean, racism, climate change, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, coronavirus, the economy that's just cratered, poverty, child sex trafficking. And it's not feasible that we're all going to be able to become super educated, super up-to-date experts on every single one of these issues, let alone effective activists on every single one of these issues. In fact, I think if we tried to be activists on every problem that needed to be solved, we would probably not have that, you know, very much of an impact, right? You have to become a deep expert and really spend the time to know things and to dedicate that time to a single issue. So how do you think we should balance that in our lives? You know, as you know, you want to be an ally, and yet you run up against this non-renewable finite resource of time. How do you decide what to devote your time to? What is enough in any one of these causes or issues that you want to be a productive person helping to move things forward in a positive way?
Well, I think when we look at a lot of the issues, and particularly the issues you've just mentioned, I think they have common roots. I think the sort of erasure, the mistreatment, the outright abuse and murder of trans people is linked in the same way to the abuse of Black and global majority people. It's linked to like all kinds of class struggles and economic issues. I think so many of these things are intertwined because they are the result of a society that has decided that some people are more valuable or worthwhile or deserving of our protection and respect than others. And I think once we get down to the understanding that once we can establish a baseline of respect for people who are not just like us, but for people on the basis of their humanity, then I think we can be effective allies in a lot of areas, in a lot of intersectional areas simultaneously. Because once we decide that all people are people and all people are deserving of our respect and our care and our protection, then we can do that. Like, I don't see my work around race as being separate at all from the work around gender, from work around sexuality, from work around the non-binary community, but from any of these things, they're all so interlinked. And in the introduction to Anti-Racist Ally, I say this book is primarily about race and secondarily about gender, but we can be an ally to any group that is marginalized in a way that we're not. So once we look at ourselves, we can understand that we are all intersectional. I am not just Black. I am not just woman. I am not just heterosexual or able-bodied. I'm all of those things all of the time. And you can't interact with just one of those parts of me. And once we recognize that not only we are intersectional, but everyone who we come into contact with every day is intersectional, then we can say, okay, society doesn't uplift womanness in the same way that it uplifts manness. It doesn't uplift Blackness in the same way in the West that it uplifts whiteness. So those are areas where I don't have areas of privilege, but I am able-bodied. I am in a heterosexual relationship. I am not neurodivergent. And so what can I do to identify the ways that I can use those privileges, those areas that I don't have to struggle, to uplift those groups who do struggle? So I think once we recognize where we have privileges and where we have obstacles, we can turn those obstacles into allyship and support for other groups. No matter what the topic is, I think once we develop a baseline of respect and understanding, then we can apply that equally to so many different groups of people and challenges that we see.
What did you think of the recent report by the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities that determined there was no evidence for institutional racism in the UK?
I think it's nonsense. And I think we should be ashamed of our government for producing that.
Yeah. I mean, the reason it concerns me is because I fear that it will make, so what are the words? I want to be really deliberate about this because it is such a, you know, it's such a complex issue, but you have to name a problem to solve it, right? I think that's really important. And I think there are a lot of people who don't spend their time thinking about race because they don't have to, right? They might think about other things. They might think about poverty and they might think about, again, misogyny or, you know, something else, but they don't think about race. And so if we have this report that says, don't worry, nothing to see here, move along, you know, then I think it, unfortunately, it might give a false sense of security to exactly the sort of people that need to be allies in order for things to improve. But I don't know why, because it's so fucking obvious that there still is institutional racism, right? It's like so obvious. It's like, use your common sense. And so I'm not sure how anybody could have looked at the state of play and said, just move along, nothing to see here.
The UK government currently is led by a man who referred to Black people as having watermelon smiles, who referred to hijab wearers as looking like letterboxes, who has said so many other terrible things. And I mean, of course, a government that doesn't want to acknowledge that there's a problem would put out a study that says that there isn't a problem. Like, that fear that you have, I think, is a fear of the report doing exactly what the report has been designed to do. To say there's nothing to see here, look away, everything's fine. To frame the UK as, I don't remember exactly the term, like an example that countries should follow, something like that. Like, of course, it's a branding exercise. Of course, when people with a vested interest in maintaining the status quo, in maintaining inequities, in a party named the Conservative Party, of course, when you give these people the ability to shape the narrative, they shape it in a way that is dutiful and useful for them. And we have so many people who were quoted and cited in that study coming forward and saying, either that's not what I said, or I didn't talk to you at all for this study. I don't think that there can be any real credence put in it. But I'm certain that people who don't want to engage in this conversation will say, well, the government looked into it. The government took the time and the effort to look into this, and there's no problem. So there's no problem. So of course it will comfort people who want to be comforted, because I think that's the very purpose of it.
Yeah. I mean, on the subject of Boris Johnson, I want to ask you about the glass cliff. And I wax lyrical about the glass cliff when it comes to women in power all the time. I know you have done a TED talk specifically on the glass cliff as it relates to larger groups of marginalized communities. Can you, for our listeners, explain briefly what the glass cliff is? And I want to ask a question about it in the context of Boris Johnson.
So the glass cliff is a situation, and I feel like I'm just going to reel off this intro to my TED talk now because it's like so like ingrained in my head. The glass cliff is a situation that underrepresented leaders, by which in this case I mean women and racially marginalized men, find themselves in when they break through the glass ceiling. So essentially, studies have found that when a underrepresented leader is appointed to the most senior position within a business, so board member, CEO type role, that those businesses are more likely than not to have already been through a period of at least 5 consecutive months of poor performance in one way or another. And so people are getting the opportunity to come in and lead businesses, but they're getting the opportunity to come in and lead businesses that are already in some kind of problem or already having some kind of long-term issue. And then what we're finding is that these people are not hired with the expectation that they're going to make transformational change. Instead, they're hired for a perception of them having soft skills, of them being good managers of people. And so we bring people in to businesses that aren't doing well. We don't give them the tools or the time to make change or to be successful in their new roles. And then we see that at a greater proportion than white male leaders, marginalized leaders are forced out of those leadership positions and they are replaced with white male leaders, which is known as the savior effect. So we're putting people into positions that in businesses that aren't doing well, we're not giving them the tools or the time to succeed. And then we're replacing them with what has been the status quo, a white male. And we're saying, well, that person couldn't fix the problem. What we need is a traditional leader. And so we get this sort of looping cycle of people not believing that underrepresented people can do the jobs because they're only being given the opportunity to do the job when it has a lower chance of success.
Yeah. So for me, watching the state of politics over the last 3 years, particularly, I feel like we have the perfect example of the way that a glass cliff works in watching Theresa May followed by Boris Johnson. Now, let me just say, let me just get out there that I was not a fan of Theresa May. I am not a fan of conservative politics. I've had conservatives on this show, and I'm very interested in having open and honest dialogue with people of all different persuasions. But I did not support Brexit. I didn't think Theresa May was a good leader. And yet, I also saw a mess made by a white male leader who then stepped down. I saw no men put themselves forward for the job. So this impossible task was given to Theresa May.
Who had been openly not pro-Brexit before she was appointed.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, indeed. It was openly not pro-Brexit. She had a fairly impossible task of trying to bring together the very, you know, different factions in her own party. And I would also conjecture not the skills probably to do that. But honestly, it was an impossible task anyway. And inevitably, she failed. You know, inevitably she failed. And then we had, you know, the quote unquote savior, Boris Johnson, come in, deliver a Brexit deal by compromising on things he's never, he said he would never compromise on. And I just feel like if we ever doubted this phenomenon, it's, you know, because it's obviously it's not just in companies. It's also, it's really in all positions of power. I feel like we just need to open our eyes and look at the last couple of years in this story that we're all familiar with, at least in the UK, and see this is how it worked. Because Boris Johnson got through a deal that Theresa May never could have. Sorry, I should let you talk. I'm interviewing you. I'm on my high horse because I feel so passionately about this.
No, I completely agree. And Theresa May is the perfect example, but it's one that I can't use because people have such strong feelings about her as a person and her leadership. And I don't know if people have equally strong feelings about David Cameron's leadership, for example. But people have a lot of emotion tied up with the Theresa May narrative. And so while she is a really great, clear, obvious example of the glass death, she's one that's hard to use. But I do completely agree. She got handed a role that was actually in opposition to the things that she had said she believed. She still was handed that role to do that piece of work, and was then replaced by a white male who, as you say, was able to push through things that she wasn't able to. And I don't know enough about her in sort of an individual policy level to know if she did lack the skills to be able to do that. But I do think she lacked the support and opportunity to be able to do the role that she was hired to do. And I think we don't always think about politics in terms of hired roles, but these people are hired and they're hired by us and we pay their salaries and they're very much hired job roles. And we do see it play out, as you say, in all kinds of positions of power.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the US, and I'm not familiar enough with political history in the UK, so please do educate me, but if I've got anything wrong, but in the US, dating all the way back to Harriet Tubman, Black women have been really the backbone of a lot of social movements and progress. I mean, it took a broad coalition to get rid of Trump, but we all owe a huge debt of gratitude. I mean, all of us that obviously didn't want to see Trump get into a second term owe a huge debt of gratitude specifically to Black women who voted overwhelmingly for Biden.
And to Stacey Abrams, who worked so hard. Yeah.
Yes. Stacey Abrams is absolutely my hero. It's my dream. It's my dream to meet her and to interview her. I mean, because she is everything we need, in my view, in an example of a powerful Black woman. She's incredibly intelligent. She's incredibly compassionate. She is so fucking competent. You know, like she really, like she knows politics, like everything down to the detail. And what she has been able to help catalyze in Georgia is, I mean, it's generational change. It's incredible. And the fact that she could bounce back from a loss that was, I don't want to say it was stolen, but let's just say it was, you know, I don't think we can look at the voting laws and say they are fair or ethical in Georgia. And the fact that she could bounce back from that with such resilience, she's an example to all people, let alone, you know, all women, let alone all Black women, I feel.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting, like you said, that she is so competent. And, you know, we talk about her strength and like all of these things. And I think what we often leave out of that conversation is she has to be. For a Black woman to be taken seriously, to be listened to have any kind of credence, we can't just rock up and sort of know a little bit about what we're saying. We have to be subject matter experts. We have to, you know, really know our stuff and be willing to go to the wall and to really advocate for ourselves and to push that narrative of being informed, because the default is to presume that we're not and to treat us as though we're not. And I think that's a really important nuance as well.
Absolutely. So while we have this history, at least in the US, of really effective political activism and advocacy and community building by Black women, what we don't have are many Black women in seats of power where decisions are made, in spite of, as you detail well in your book, the stereotype, one of the stereotypes of Black women as the strong Black woman. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a nuanced and complicated problem. But what do you think we can start doing today to help elevate more Black women to positions of power?
Well, I think we need to be mindful of the systems and structures that we work within. You can start by looking around your workplace, for example. How many people there are non-white? How many people there are in leadership positions who aren't men? Because what we find is we often have hiring managers who hire people who are reminiscent to them of themselves, because we have an idea of what success looks like, especially if we view ourselves as a successful person. And so often people hire within that image. So the first thing you can do is you can take a look around and you can just notice and acknowledge who is in the spaces where you are and who is not in the spaces where we are. And if we see that there is not a wide mixture of people in the spaces where we are, we need to start considering what is keeping those people out of those spaces. And that's going to be different in 100 different workplaces, in 100 different contexts, in all kinds of different situations. But the first thing we can do is to be aware. And then the second thing we can do is we can challenge. We can say, it's really interesting to me that we have only X percentage of this type of person. So for example, in London, the London Black population is about 40%. So if your workplace doesn't have about 40% Black people and you're based in London, then you're not hiring in a way that's reflective of the demographic of that society. Mm. And if that's happening, there's a reason for that. Or if you notice that you've got lots and lots of marginalized people or underrepresented people, but they're all clustered in entry-level or junior roles or in service roles where they provide a service to someone else, then again, we have what's known as occupational segregation, the clustering of groups of people by a protected characteristic, your race, your gender, your ethnicity, your sexuality, all of those things. The first thing we can do is look around. Then we can acknowledge, then we can challenge. We can start to say, why is this? What can we do about this? But I think what we can't do is just imagine that there is a single one-size-fits-all solution that we can just apply universally. Because when we try to do that, it doesn't work. And then people become disheartened and they disengage from the topic entirely. So it's about finding, as you say, the nuance in your specific situation and working with people in positions of power there to challenge and to open out those spaces. And until those spaces are opened out, if you're in that space and you have a voice, and however junior you are, however sort of whatever else, if you're in that space, you can use your voice to amplify the message of underrepresented people. So that's not to say, oh, if I were Black, I would want someone to say this. But to actually speak to people who are not like yourself, to hear their actual messages and to take those messages into those spaces. So it's not about reinterpreting or making up a narrative for people. It's about hearing those voices, hearing those messages, and then using your privilege of access to space to take those messages into those places. It's a long answer, sorry.
No. I think it's so important. I really do. I want to drill down on something you just said, which is speak to people who are not like yourself. So I want to try to square this circle between, you know, like you say in your book on allyship, that part of allyship is having difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. But you also say learning is great, but putting someone else in the position of having to teach you is not. Mm-hmm. So how can we both have difficult conversations with people that are not like us, that enhance our understanding and our empathy, but also be respectful of emotional labor?
I think they're two slightly separate things. So when I'm saying having difficult conversations, I'm not really talking about the conversations that you have with marginalized groups. I would like those conversations to be respectful. I'd like those conversations to be attentive. And I'd like marginalized groups to be centered in those conversations. And so what I mean when I say have difficult conversations is really the next step of that, because it's difficult to go to your workplace and say, why does everyone here look like me? It's difficult to say to your parent, actually, that word that you use has this meaning and it's damaging in that way. Those are the kinds of difficult conversations I want people to have, to challenge people who have a privilege to consider that privilege and how to best use it. Then the piece about learning is great, turning other people into your teachers is not. That's about what we demand of people with marginalized experiences. And so there are people like me who do work like me. And I think I'm able to do this work because I am a very privileged, light-skinned Black woman. And so I'm aware that the experiences that I have are not even comparable to the experiences that a darker-skinned Black woman would have, to the experiences that a disabled, darker-skinned Black trans woman has. Like, as my intersections go, I'm very privileged. And so I'm willing to spend my time and energy putting resources out into the world, whether that is books, whether that's podcasts, whether that is newsletters or Instagram posts or whatever that is. I'm putting that out into the world because I've chosen to, and people can engage with that. And that means that people don't have to, you know, tap their Black neighbor on the shoulder and say, tell me all of the worst thing that's happened to you. Tell me all the things that have hurt you. Because there is information out there without you having to put that burden onto other people. So yeah, maybe I could have phrased it better or differently in the book, but I do see those as separate things.
Yeah, it's something that we need to be mindful of. And also, as you rightly point out, this is absolutely not a new phenomenon, but to some people it really is. And so we're kind of learning those to people for whom, I mean, you know, to me, it's fairly new, right? So I'm still learning the etiquette and I'm learning how to be respectful as I'm engaging, right? So, you know, that's why I asked the question.
No, I've got no problem with the question. I'm sorry if it seemed like I did, but also it's really interesting to me to understand that for some people it is new, because to me, I can't imagine it being new. I can't imagine it not being something that I have thought about. My race is something that I've thought about, I'd say every day since I was at primary school, every day since I was 3 or 4 or 5 years old, I've been aware of my race. And so having in mind that it is a new conversation for some people is probably not something that I do very well. And when I say, like, I could have expressed that better, or I don't do this well, I'm not looking for someone to say, no, no, don't worry. I'm trying to acknowledge areas where I can improve and do better and add more value by understanding other people's perspectives, because that's what I'm asking people to do. I'm asking people to understand the perspectives and experiences of marginalized groups. And so I also have to be willing to do that in how I communicate.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think for those of us who have been, I don't want to speak for anybody else. Let me just speak for myself. Growing up in California, quite politically aware, I recall there was a mental shift for me that is kind of akin to what we're experiencing in this moment, at least in my own personal development. And that was reading Beloved by Toni Morrison. I mean, obviously she is incredible and all of her work is incredible. Yeah. But Beloved was just one of those books. I read it at 17. And for some reason, and I would have thought I was the smart person. I was well-educated. I was, you know, I was in good classes and did fairly well in school. I was obviously very aware of slavery. I was aware that we enslaved people and made them work, which is awful. And I was aware that we killed them if they tried to run away, which is awful. But I had not made the connection that we dehumanized them and abused them. And it wasn't just the work. It was really treating them and just that they were often treated as cattle in big ways and small. Yeah. And it was like this shift for me that I was like, oh, this is a much more profound and deep wound that we have to heal. Of course, it's not going to be healed in a couple of generations by just proclaiming everybody as equal. And I feel like potentially we're having a similar moment, like, where a lot of people would be like, well, no, I know that there is racism. But then you, again, you have this evidence now and you're like, oh, oh, it runs so deeply. Oh, all of the extensive abuse of power and the fear that people might have, like you said, in the US where the police are militarized. You know, I think the understanding is becoming a little bit deeper of the problem.
Absolutely. And I think once we get even deeper into it, we have to acknowledge that race isn't real. Like, race is a construct, and it's a construct that was only developed a few hundred years ago to be able to classify and dehumanize certain groups of people. Like, there's so much to it, and there's so much, like you say, that of course can't be overridden in a generation or two. And even in a generation or two, that's still someone's grandparent or great-grandparent, someone who they are alive and can speak to, can have been born into slavery still. Like, it's not yesterday's problem. We still actively live with the ramifications of it, and not just of slavery. The dehumanization of Black and global majority people has had an impact on where people can live, what their access is to food, what their access is to education, to medical care, because of redlining and because of where people could get mortgages or were allowed to live, or the ghettoization of different communities. Like, there's so much that we mean when we say Black Lives Matter, and there's so much that we mean when we say that we have to do better in so many areas. And yeah, it's really big. And that means that there's a lot of work to be done in unpacking and overcoming it.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And I just want to sit on that for a moment. There is so much that we mean when we say Black Lives Matter. And that's why this conversation, you know, we need to keep having it. And we really do need to dig down as deeply as we possibly can. I know that we have a hard stop in just a few minutes. I want to be respectful of your time. And so I'd like to close on just a few quick fire questions. What's one lesson you've learned the hard way?
One lesson that I've learned the hard way. I guess I've learned that, and it sounds so obvious, like we say it to children, but not everyone's going to like you and you're not going to like everyone else. But that doesn't mean that's no impact on who you are. It's just people.
Yeah. Yeah. The overcoming the need to be liked is a hard one, I think, for a lot of women.
I was going to say that I think the only reason I'm able to do the work that I do is because I have developed a high tolerance for dislikability. Because people don't like you talking about race. People don't like you talking about gender. People don't like these conversations. They don't make people comfortable. And so developing a tolerance for dislikability is the only way that I've been able to do the work that I do, I think.
I can resonate with that so deeply, so deeply. Every time I do an interview and the online trolls come out, I almost just wear it as a point of pride at this stage. What don't women talk enough about?
Women do not talk about money enough.
Oh, amen.
Women are getting shortchanged in all kinds of ways. And again, like race, we've been taught not to talk about money. And that means that it just continues because we don't have the knowledge that we could use to make that change.
What's an opinion you once held strongly that you've since changed your mind about?
Okay, a less serious one. I've always been desperately anti-Crocs. I've now got two pairs of Crocs because they are the best shoes. And I've convinced so many other people to get Crocs. Because if you're going to be marching, if you're going to be protesting, if you're going to be doing this work, you need some comfortable shoes.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Crocs, come and sponsor our podcast. What unearned privilege or unfair advantage has been most instrumental to your success so far?
A hundred, a thousand. I am able-bodied. I was born into a country where I have so many more resources than so many people all over the world. In sort of my personal context, I am light-skinned as a Black woman, which isn't at all more of an advantage than being white, but it is an advantage and a privilege within the Black spectrum. Like, there are so many privileges that I'm aware of. And part of the definition of privilege is that those who hold it are often not aware of it. So I can't imagine how many advantages I've had that I don't even see and can't even acknowledge.
What are you still insecure about?
I've just started a new job and I want to be good at it.
Congratulations. What are you doing, can I ask?
Yeah, so I am managing production planning for Netflix across EMEA.
Amazing.
And so I want to be good at it. And so I guess because I'm in this new phase, I'm insecure about, you know, my ability to do a new job, just like anyone starting a new role is.
When do you feel you're most powerful?
I mean, to be honest, I feel quite powerful. And I have felt quite powerful for the last year. And that has been good and it has been scary. So I felt powerful because in the last year, I've suddenly developed a platform, I've published 2 books. So suddenly people are willing to listen to what I have to say. And that's an incredible power. But like any other privilege, it's a huge responsibility. And I feel like I need to be very up on everything I say and have all my facts in order and all my sources, which, to be honest, is a good thing. So, yeah, in the last year, I have felt very powerful.
I'm going off the quick fire now, but just as you've mentioned this, when your Instagram post went viral and you thousands of followers in a matter of days, I think, were you ready for that? Did you feel ready for that platform?
No, absolutely not. What? Of course not. So just to give your listeners some context, I was already writing Millennial Black. I had sold it to HarperCollins. And I felt like everyone who had a book deal was an influencer, which I absolutely wasn't. And so I started an Instagram account, which was at Official Millennial Black, to talk about Blackness and womanness and to build up a community. And eventually, long term, transparently, build up a community who might be interested in buying and reading my book. And that was like literally starting from scratch. So I had maybe 100, 200 followers when George Floyd was murdered. And my background has always been in working in social. And so I spent a lot of time crying and feeling very powerless. And then I thought, okay, well, social is what I do. I'm just going to make a post. And it was at a time where people weren't making multi-post informational carousels. And people weren't talking about race online in the same way that they are now. And so I just made this post, presumed no one would see it. Kind of overnight, it went from me having 100, 200, whatever followers to having 10,000 followers. And I was like, oh, I'm going to do a swipe up. I wonder what that's like. To then getting, within a couple of weeks, 50,000, 100,000, almost 200,000 followers incredibly quickly. And no, there was no way I could have been prepared for that because I felt like I was talking to 100 people.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an incredible story. And, you know, you obviously were an expert in social before then, but it also, I think, goes to show how much your message was needed in that moment, how, you know, it was really the message for that moment and is still needed now.
Thank you.
Even if it's stumbled upon, become a voice for what a lot of us need to hear right now and wanted to hear.
Thank you. I didn't plan it. I'm glad that it happened, and I'm going to do my best to keep having the conversations that I can about the things that seem important because, again, as a very light-skinned Black woman with a platform, that feels like a responsibility, and I'm going to do my best to meet that responsibility the best way that I can.
Okay, last one of the quick fire rounds. What are you really fucking good at?
Oh, loads. I'm really good at social. I just recently tried to remodel my own bathroom. I'm really bad at remodeling my own bathroom. I think I'm really good, and this is something I've learned recently, at taking difficult or complex things and making them seem approachable. And I think that's why my Instagram works. I think that's why Anti-Racist Ally works, because I think I can synthesize information down in a way that stops it feeling scary.
That's amazing. I'm a real believer in the power of stories and narrative to change things. And I mentioned Beloved having changed my perspective very, very deeply on something. I'm wondering if you have any fiction to recommend to help us in this conversation.
That's interesting, because having written... It sounds like such a humble brag. Having written 2 books in the last year, I haven't had time to do a lot of reading because I have like a part of my brain that I think of as my words brain, and I couldn't fill it up with putting stuff in when I was trying to put stuff out. But I recently read What a Fun Age, which is a really, really incredible book about a young Black woman's experience in America, I think New York, and that's fiction and it's great. And I'm just starting to read Queenie by Candice Carty-Williams. And I'm not far into that, but it also seems to be giving a really good, modern, interesting snapshot into a modern Black woman's experience moving through the world.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Sophie. If people want to learn more about you, if they want to read your books, if they want to follow you, where should they go?
So you can follow me on Instagram, which is at Official Millennial Black. I'm not on Twitter because Twitter is scary. I have my first book, Anti-Racist Ally, which is a little unintimidating pocket-sized pink book about how we can all sort of be better allies. That came out in October of 2020 and is available at all good bookshops. And my next book, Millennial Black, which is a much bigger, more in-depth look at Black women's experiences in UK and US workplaces, and it's again available wherever you get your books from, ideally a Black-owned bookstore if possible. And my TEDx talk about the glass cliff is on YouTube. I'm all over the place.
Thank you so much, Sophie. I have about 6 pages of unanswered questions, or questions I didn't get to, I shouldn't say unanswered, unasked questions is a better way to put it. So maybe we can have you back again another time.
Yeah, that would be great. It was really nice to meet you and have a chat with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
If you've enjoyed the series so far, please do subscribe, rate, and leave a review wherever you're listening right now. It really does help us reach incredible women to introduce you to on the show. While you're at it, check out the show notes for more info on our guests and to find out how to reach us on all the socials. Thanks for listening, and I'll meet you here again next week.